Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program was brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
Hey, 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 I'm Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway, and it's getting into almost holiday season. And of course, we just had a number of holidays, particularly Yom Kippur in the Jewish traditions, and we'll see more of them to come. So today I'm really excited. We're talking with an author who has just written a book called The Jewish Soul Food from Minsk to Marrakesh. It is Jana Gur. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And you're sort of an expert. You've been writing about Israeli cuisine for forever, it seems. You've written the magazine, the leading Israeli food and wine magazine, and also the new Israeli cookbook. Mm-hmm.
The book of the new book Israeli food. It's already not so new, so new is in Israeli food. The book is, I think, 7 years old by now.
Well, congratulations in this new book.
Thank you.
Is so exciting and beautiful looking.
Thank you very much.
If you don't mind, I kind of wanted to read a little bit from the introduction because it was fascinating stories you captured here. But you write, today more and more Israelis are aware of the importance of preserving their family cooking heritages. Self-published family cookbooks have become very common, and it is touching to see how much love and longing are invested in these modest publications. Still, the big question looms. Can these cuisines, which are products of the unique circumstances of Jewish life in places like Iraq, Turkey, Yemen, Morocco, or Poland, really survive in their new home? Or to put it in simpler words, who will cook this food in the next generation, and who will eat it? I just thought that was a really interesting way that this book sort of diverges from your last cookbook, talking about the new exciting trends in Israeli food that you spoke of in that book. And here we sort of go back to a lot of the traditions that from the Jewish diaspora, from other countries and other influences, and how they've forged their own unique cuisines. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, tell me a little bit about the premise for this book and how you got inspired to write it.
I think the quote you just mentioned is a very good place to start. Mm-hmm. And you're right. In the Book of New Israeli Food, I was celebrating our brave new food culture. But our brave new culture actually thrives on the heritage of Jewish cuisines. And Israeli food is basically a fusion of Middle Eastern cooking, that is, you know, our local cooking, and of course cooking of Jewish immigrants that came from so many places. And what we basically cook, it's not yet a cuisine, is a mixture of all these influences. However, Jewish cuisines per se, I mean Jewish cuisine that developed over thousands of years in the diaspora all over the world, are, in my opinion, not just in my opinion, endangered species, are on the verge of extinction, simply because they represent cultures and lifestyles that do not exist anymore in their original provenance. I mean, no Jews or almost no Jews live anymore in places like Iraq, Persia, Yemen, Morocco, Hungary.
And these are places where there's ancient Jewish cuisine.
Absolutely. Yeah. Iraqi, for example, Iraqi Jewish cuisine goes back over 2,000 years old. It is really probably the most ancient Iraqi cuisine in general, not just, you know, not just Jewish Iraqi cuisine. And Israel today, we're in a very kind of lucky circumstances. Israel today still has all of these cuisines simultaneously, right, because there are enough first-generation immigrants who cook these foods and who feed other people with these amazing dishes. But we do not really know, or we can safely assume it won't long for a lot of time, because this is grandmother style of cooking, because Israel is just too small and too dense and too...
And changing,
precisely. So it's safe to assume that most of these dishes will be not actually lost, but won't be part of culinary mainstream, so to speak. However, some of them are in Israel. Some of them have already become a part of our culinary repertoire. And the premise of my book was actually to bring these dishes, what we call the greatest hits of our grandmothers from all over the Jewish diaspora, to primarily North American reader, Jewish or non-Jewish, it doesn't really matter. I said, listen, these are amazing dishes. Why not? Because the only way to really preserve a cuisine is to cook it and find as many people as possible who want to eat it.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it just remains folklore, you know, food history. This is not really living cuisine.
And looking through this, I can kind of see why these recipes have been so treasured and replicated by these grandmothers. I love how you write that it wasn't sort of you who chose them, but these dishes were sort of a natural selection.
Exactly.
Of folks who just adored them.
I think the word that I would give myself, the title I would give myself, and I'm proud to give myself, would be a curator, really, because I did have all that wealth of recipes in my disposal, and all I had to do is, you know, to choose and maybe to tweak them a little bit so they will be more suitable for international audience. But basically, you're absolutely right. It's not me who chose them. And I think that's the beauty of it. Mm-hmm. That's kind of, you know, seal of approval. It's not just my crazy taste. These are dishes that people picked up, singled out, and adopted because of their deliciousness and because of their practicality and relevance to our modern lifestyle.
They're survivors.
Exactly.
And what would you say, is that the meaning of the soul food? And you're invoking the word soul food. Is it about memory? Is it nostalgia? Is it about...
It's a very good question. I've been asked that several times. And every time I answer it, I kind of get more and more insights. Because, first of all, soul food is, it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, because soul food is primarily associated with...
the American South.
Exactly. However, the same year my book came out, about half a year before my book, there was another book called Jewish, In Search of Jewish Soul Food, a book about the knish, one of the iconic Jewish Ashkenazi dishes.
I had authors on the show who Japanese soul cooking.
Okay, but this was actually, was Jewish soul food.
Got it.
So
it
was called, I think, Knish in Search of Jewish Soul Food. So this term already becomes sort of, I'm not sure pervasive, but it does exist. But this book, let's put it this way, certain dishes for certain people would be their soul food.
Yeah,
And it happens every time people leaf through the book and say, this is what my grandmother used to make. Oh, I still remember that one. For others, these same dishes would be kind of exotic or new. So one soul...
For me, yeah.
So one, it's, you know, like somebody's rich. It really depends on who's looking at the book. But someone, you can be sure that every one of these dishes makes someone cry.
It's emotional.
Yes, but
meaning,
other people can say, okay, maybe I didn't grow up eating this kind of food, but it sounds and looks tempting, so why not try it? Mm-hmm. And maybe for my children, it will become their soul food.
That's fabulous. Mm-hmm. I love that you preserve these, and it seems like you really took from a lot of different chefs and tried to choose the versions, because there's so many different ways to make a lot of these recipes.
Yeah.
I loved reading about how your chopped liver recipe, you're inspired by one version that had more onions to liver for that wonderful texture.
And flavor, because actually fried onions in general are like the basis, what makes the flavor in Ashkenazi cooking, not just in the chopped liver. But in chopped liver, definitely the sweet kind of luscious taste of very, very slowly fried onions is what gives, in my opinion, chopped liver its charm. By the way, interesting anecdote. In the 50s, last century, in mm-hmm. Israel, it was period known as the Age of Austerity. It was very, very harsh economic situations. Yeah. Shortly after the State of Israel was founded, there was shortage on very many, you know, basic products. And there were a lot of substitutes that were devised by, you know, home cooks. Mm. And one of them was a fake chopped liver.
Oh.
And it was made with eggplants, or, you know, famously versatile, and you can basically make anything you like with them. But what made the flavor were the fried onions.
Wow.
So once you add fried onions, you kind of have this. And that it was so good that up to this very day in a deli, you can buy a chopped fake liver salad made with eggplants and fried onions.
Oh my goodness. That sounds great.
It does.
And it's funny because, like, the term chopped liver and just using offal in general is associated with austerity as well.
Yeah.
But this is going deeper.
Yeah, well, austerity could be relative, you know.
Right, right. So you live in Tel Aviv mm-hmm. currently. And, you know, there's so much going on right now in Israel. I just wanted to ask, how is it living there right now?
You mean food-wise or generally?
The culture. I mean, I wanted to really ask you about all the turmoil in this era in Israel as a whole, and whether you think, you know, what you think, because you've been living there since 1974.
Right.
Where you think this might take the culture and the cuisine.
You mean the political turmoil?
Yes.
That's a tough one. Political turmoil, unfortunately, is part of our life. Right. And I know that lately things are even more kind of messy than they used to be in the last years. But culturally speaking and culinary speaking, there is so much going on. I sometimes wonder whether these two things have anything to do with each other. You know, people not taking anything for granted, the sense of urgency, the need, you know, to enjoy life, to create things, because the future is not always very certain.
Right.
So it probably adds the edge. You know, I hear many Israelis who don't live in Israel anymore, live some, you know, very quiet place like Canada
uh-huh.
or Denmark. And so everything is just fine, but we're a bit bored.
Yeah.
We're used to action, but, well, this is not the kind of action we're looking for. But Tel Aviv especially is sizzling
right.
With exciting cuisine, with art, with fashion, with culture. And even during, you know, the war last summer, it was terrible for all of us. You know, people went out, they went to restaurants, and mm-hmm. even though there were sirens sometimes in the middle, Israelis have this really lustful life. They do. And part of it is food. Very
That's
big part of it. Yeah.
Yeah, I loved reading about how you began writing the magazine. And I'm sorry, what was it called again? The culinary magazine?
It's called Al HaShulchan in Hebrew, which means okay. on the table.
All right. You started writing it at a time that it just sort of intersected with this renaissance mm-hmm. of culinary interest. And then there's all of a sudden new cheese producers mm-hmm. and all sorts of specialty grocers, olive oils and mm-hmm. so forth at yeah. the same time. So, and do you see that continuing to flourish?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
It's getting stronger?
Absolutely. It mm-hmm. started, it did start in, you know, early 90s, late 80s. It coincided with our founding the magazine, which is really, we were really very lucky and very privileged to be able to be part of it and to document it and encourage it. And it was really fun. And it does go on. I think now we're witnessing the second generation, you know, the millennials.
Yeah, who grew up with great food.
Exactly. They grew up with the great food. They're very relaxed about it. They don't take it, you know, they're not into, you know, very fancy gourmet stuff, but they know their wine, they know their bread, they know where to shop. They go out a lot, and they would go out to places like, you know, like Roberta's, mm-hmm. like the one we're just next to, kind of market restaurants, places that don't take themselves too seriously, but still serve really mm-hmm. good food. And I think Jewish ethnic food is part of it. I mean, we do see a lot of... For example, there is a little cute restaurant in Tel Aviv that serves Iraqi kuba soup, the famous dumpling soup, but mm-hmm. also Swedish meatballs. Because the owner grew up in Sweden. He's an Israeli who, I think, moved when he was a kid with his family and then came back. And he learned how to make kuba from his Iraqi grandmother. But he also has some Swedish meatballs in his repertoire. So it's kind of this mishmash. Delicious.
That sounds great. Yeah, it sounds like it's reached a sort of wizened place or more...
Yeah, by the way, the recipe for the beet kuba soup in my book is, awesome. Is the one from this guy. He's really awesome.
Oh, so cool. I want to talk about lots more about the recipes, mm-hmm. but we're going to first quick cut to a little commercial interlude and be right back.
Electric Latin Soul, go, go.
You are listening to ELS by Renee Lopez.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years. So it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
All right, we're back chatting more with author Jana Gur of Jewish Soul Food from Minsk to Marrakesh. And there are more than 100 unforgettable dishes updated for today's kitchen, which is the subtitle, in this book. Flipping through it, I love how you have a little note above each recipe about the provenance mm-hmm. of that recipe. And just, you know, even flipping through some section like even the desserts, there's such... interesting smorgasbord. There's Turkish, there's Sephardic, Egyptian, Persian, Moroccan, what else? There was Bulgarian, there was an American one, which was the barbecued beef brisket, which is really fun. So tell me a little bit about the main differences between, because, you know, we're in New York, so we know the Ashkenazi Jewish foods traditions. And I see a lot of Sephardic foods. Mm-hmm. What are some of the main differences between those two?
Wow, these are, first of all, even Sephardic food is like an umbrella definition. There are so many within, you know, Sephardic world, so many differences. Ashkenazi food is universally recognized as Jewish food. I mean, people, when they say Jewish food, even in Israel, if there is a restaurant that calls itself a Jewish restaurant, it would serve Ashkenazi food. Okay. If it serves Jewish Moroccan food, it would call itself Moroccan restaurant. So it's kind of funny.
Uh-huh.
But in this book, there is, I think, about 15% Ashkenazi recipes. And the rest is the rest. I don't even like to use the word Sephardi because, for example, Iraqi cuisine, which I think is most probably the most represented cuisine in this book simply because it's so amazing, it's not properly Sephardi because Sephard means in Hebrew Spain, and Sephardi cooking is cooking of descendants of Spanish Jews who mainly moved to Turkey,
Morocco.
Bulgaria, parts of Morocco. Okay. There is Spanish Morocco, but there is also other parts in Morocco that are not, I mean, their cooking is not Sephardi. And it is indeed different. So in Yemenite cooking, for example, that is, again, very unique, especially their breads and their baked products.
I love how you have this bread, the Yemenite bread that is a very ancient
Which one?
Cuisine.
There are two. The lachuch, the pan-fried bread.
Yes, that one.
That's really cool. That's called lachuch. It's a cross between a pancake. I just missed it. It's actually made in a pan. It's a flatbread, but it's yeasted pan bread. British people say it's a little bit like a crumpet.
It does look like that.
It does look like a crumpet. It's delicious as a wrap. Mm-hmm. And you can just dip,
Or something.
Yeah, it's really good, and it's really easy to make. This is, by the way, was one of my criteria when I was picking the recipes, things that people will actually make that are not overly complicated or do not involve, you know, very fancy ingredients or equipment. And this is a really good example because it's just all you need is a pan,
mm-hmm.
and some dough and yeast and water, and here you go.
And I love that you mentioned the Iraqi Jewish cooking, mm-hmm. Is well represented here, and it's something that I don't think I would get to try or see too often. And this sweet and sour fish casserole with eggplant and tomatoes looks absolutely amazing.
Yeah, this is one of my favorites and very easy to make. Interestingly, another thing I like about Iraqi cuisine, beside the fact that it has so many delicious dishes, is that this is one of the more distinctive Jewish cuisine, because in many cases, Jewish cuisine was very similar to that of their non-Jewish neighbors. For example, Moroccan Jewish cuisine is not that different from non-Jewish cuisine. There are a lot of similarities, obviously.
The tagine with the chicken.
Exactly. Okay. But Iraqi Jewish cuisine, probably because it's so Asian and because it had very interesting destiny, is quite different from the
non-Jewish.
Yeah, even the flavor profile. Jewish Iraqi cuisine is kind of sweet and sour, like the dish you mentioned, and others that have a similar flavor profile, as opposed to non-Jewish or to Muslim Iraqi cuisine that is more kind of savory, spicy.
Wow.
So it is different.
So it's really its own thing.
Yeah.
It's outside of
both
Iraqi and
Jewish. Yeah, because they've been around for over 2,000 years. And for example, if you look at the cover
recipe. Yes, I was about to talk about this. And I hear it's like the rock star of Israel.
It is the rock star of Israel. It's already in existence in New York for the last decade, thanks to Taim, you know.
Oh,
yeah,
The
food stall that sells falafel and sabich. It's called sabich. Sabich is very popular street food in Israel. And it's based on what Jewish Iraqi eat on Shabbat breakfast. Because, that on Saturday you're not supposed to do any work or cook. Mm-hmm. So all Shabbat dishes, all Saturday dishes are made in advance or cooked very slowly. And this is basically kind of a spread, morning brunch spread.
Right. Yeah.
That consists of fried eggplants, hard-boiled eggs, amba, which is a kind of unique condiment based. It's not exactly a jam. It's more like a relish based on mango.
Right.
Which, again, a mango.
A little spicy mango sauce.
Exactly. Yeah. And it comes from the reason that amba is part of Jewish Iraqi cuisine, because Iraqi Jews has a lot of connections with Indian Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only fine.
It's a good chutney.
Yeah, it's we recommend not using chutney, but pickles, because they are like Indian pickles that are more spicy. But you can also use like a harissa, any other. You need something spicy.
You need a little sauce.
Little sauce, but what makes the flavor is this beautiful combination of fried eggplants and hard-boiled eggs, which you can wrap.
I love that.
Yeah.
For those who don't see the cover right now, it's just this beautiful flatbread with fried eggplant and hard-boiled egg. And I love the sound of that combo. Egg and eggplant sandwich.
Yes.
Good for vegetarians, of course.
Absolutely. There is a vegetarian chapter.
Mm-hmm.
When I constructed the book, I thought a lot about, the way people eat today. And I believed it was really important that we have a vegetarian chapter, even though there are vegetarian recipes throughout the book, but do have a chapter that is called Meatless Mains.
Oh, okay, great.
Yeah, and sabich is not part of it because it's in the Shabbat section.
Okay. Yeah,
it is a meatless main, but also couscous, and there is other stuff that is perfect for for vegetarians.
For anyone who thought that Jewish food is all about meaty briskets, this is
again
very refreshing.
We're talking about Ashkenazi food because there weren't that many vegetables. But if you move south, you move to Middle East to the Balkans. I believe I read somewhere that in certain cultures, Jews were sometimes called vegetable eaters. They ate a lot of vegetables, perhaps because of the kosher thing. When you eat vegetable based food, you have no limitations of fleshic, milchic, kosher, etc., etc. So right. Actually, if you're an observant Jew and you're a vegetarian, you have a much easier life.
Right.
You don't have to separate anything or wait a few hours between this and that. So, and I heard more and more young observant Jews are turning in, more people are turning into vegetarians,
okay,
and vegans, but among observant Jews, it's really practical.
Yeah,
thing.
That makes sense. That's
yeah, but
really
also,
interesting.
You know, it's if we go back for a moment to meat, this is not mm-hmm. the subject of our conversation, but the reason sure. that there are so many fuss around meat, you know, in Jewish in the kosher rules that originally people were supposed to eat meat very, very rarely.
Right.
And so, as you see, there are absolutely no limitations on eating vegetables. There are no such thing as a not kosher vegetable. You can eat any vegetables, any times, or grains for that matter, or rice, or bread. Meat should be consumed in moderation. If you think about the way we look at the meat today, I think it's a very modern,
absolutely.
Very relevant...
That's definitely something we talk a lot about here at Heritage.
I can't imagine.
But it's refreshing to, you know, find recipes that do exemplify that. Mm-hmm. And thank you so much for drawing from those traditions and teaching us all. Because I see a lot of, you know, I see a lot of cookbooks these days that are very heavy on the meat in whatever cuisine it may be, just because that's today's mm-hmm. reader. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciate this.
There is meat, but
yeah,
not that much.
Of course.
And also because it's in very many places, Jewish people were quite poor. Mm-hmm. So they were experts. The Jewish homemakers were expert in stretching a little bit of meat
right.
over a lot of, you know, hungry mouths. And for example, stuffed vegetables is a very, very good example.
I loved that photo of that stuffed eggplants.
Oh,
yum.
Yes. This That's is vegetarian. Syrian, Aleppo Syrian, another amazing Jewish cuisine. And this is one of my favorites. It is takes 3 hours to cook. It uh-huh. cooks in pomegranate reduction. And in the end, the sauce is syrupy and there is fresh and dried mint. This is, I think I said, it's a grand slam of
wow.
stuffed vegetables. One of my favorites, actually.
If anyone needs some more sides at their Thanksgiving table, definitely
yes.
check
Not a side.
Out.
I would make it a main dish. You
really?
See,
okay.
You called it a side because what? Because it doesn't have enough meat?
I don't know if yeah. you're no, I don't know.
I think it is a very, very festive main, and it does have meat, a little bit of it, and other great stuff.
It's kind of like moussaka, a little bit?
No, not really.
Well, okay.
Plus, if you look at it, it's not just eggplants. There are three kinds of vegetables. There are
zucchinis
and also stuffed onion skins,
okay.
which is kind of my favorite. I love doing it. You know, take whole onion and you soften it and then you separate it and you just make like little torpedo shapes. It's one of the easiest actually vegetables to stuff.
That does look very festive and yeah. impressive. And talk a little bit about desserts.
Absolutely.
I noticed you have a Hanukkah puffs, mm-hmm. honeyed Hanukkah puffs, bimuelos.
From Sephardic cuisine. One of the, if you go a couple of pages back, mm-hmm. you know, in the area of the puffs, there is another fascinating recipe. It's called moufleta.
Okay.
Which is Moroccan. It's
that.
Actually...
I had that when I was in Morocco. Yum.
Yeah, and it's really unique because it's kind of like, it's a pancake. And it's traditionally served for a celebration called Mimuna, which comes directly after Passover. And it's like the break, the end of the Passover. And that's the celebration where you have a lot of friends and neighbors over and you have a huge table only of sweets and dessert. And moufleta is the star of the table. And you actually, you fry it on the spot and you start with one pancake and then you add another one and then you flip two of them and then you add another one and you flip three of them until you have like a stack of four or five or six, maybe 10.
That sounds fun.
It's fun.
Yeah.
I mean, I never knew how to make it and then somebody taught me mm-hmm. and I was like, you know, it was like a game to do that. And I think it's a great idea for a party.
It does. It does look like a great festive stack of piping hot, fresh.
Exactly. And you need to make them fresh. You need to make them
in. Not to be confused with moufleta.
Yes.
Well, that's about all the time we have for today. But, Jeanna, I noticed you're going to be back in New York for the Museum of Jewish Heritage, an event on Sunday, November 3rd, so that's 2 weeks from now.
Yeah.
Looking forward to that. And also, you're going to Montreal, Boston, Virginia.
Toronto.
Toronto.
New Jersey.
Short Hills, New Jersey.
Bridge.
Cool. Yeah. So, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
I'm so glad you could make it here to Bushwick.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
All right. So, check out Jewish Soul Food, just out from Shokin Books. And thanks, everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.